Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. The Hornets finally have some wins for us to talk about. They beat both Orlando and Charlotte by 3 each, and then lost to Toronto in overtime. Overall, that's a pretty good outcome. I was pretty pleased with it, and it was kind of in line with what I said. Didn't I call 2-1, Michael?
I think you did. I went the reverse jinx route and tried to go 0-3, thinking it would bring us 3 victories, only 2. But yeah, it was a good week. Walk into the week with 5 victories for the entire season, and you get 2 in 1 week. You got to take that.
All right. And if we just keep doing this for the rest of the year, we'll be in the playoffs, no problem.
Actually, I don't know. It would take over a 700 win percentage to really have a realistic shot at making the playoffs. I mean, you figure if you're looking at 43 to 45 wins minimum, Hornets would have to play over 700 ball to get into the playoffs. So I don't even know if that's realistic.
Yeah. It's clearly not realistic. I mean, we beat Charlotte by 3. We beat Orlando by 3. I mean, these aren't like world-beating teams in any sense of the word. But, you know, they were still very satisfying to watch. And I guess we should start with Orlando, though the real excitement came at the end of the week when Mr. Gordon returned. But, okay, so we're playing Orlando. And your boy, Robin Lopez.
You know, nobody has – I mean, Robin Lopez scored 29 points in this game on just 10 field goal attempts. Then hadn't been done for over 3 years when Darren Williams did it over 3 years ago. That many points on 10 or less shot attempts. That's the company that Robin Lopez keeps.
Yeah. Darren Williams, who used to be compared to Chris Paul. You notice I had to bring that up because that always like burned me that people thought Darren Williams was better than Chris Paul.
Yeah.
And no one said that anymore, are they?
Oh, no. There was actually a mention of it in this week's, if you look at the Daily Dime from yesterday on ESPN, where Mark Stein says something to the effect of, do you remember when that Chris Paul versus Darren Williams used to actually be a debate? And in my head, I was thinking, not really to me or to anybody in New Orleans. I never saw it, but yeah, it's definitely not anymore. But that's when D. Will was an all pro and Robin Lopez putting up those kind of numbers.
That's right. So we've got one all-star on our team so far. So we just need to get Davis and Anderson and Gordon on board. We'll have a quadruple all-star, just like those old Detroit teams. Not even old. I guess, what, 7 years ago, they had four all-stars in the Eastern Conference when they were winning all those games.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so all kind of sarcasm aside, I was probably more impressed with Lopez in this game than any other game this year, and it wasn't just because of his stat line. I actually, I mean, saw a couple of different moves offensively. I mean, obviously that spin move that he did on Vucevic a couple of times. I mean, he was by no means going against, you know, the best interior defense, but, you know, I thought he did more than just kind of stand by the rim and get nice passes or, you know, just lay it back up off of offensive rebounds. He actually showed a couple of nice moves, and anytime a 7-footer hits 11 out of 12 free throws, you know, that's at least got to be commended. So I was actually, you know, offensively incredibly impressed with him in this game. Of course, you know, on the boards, he had a typical Robin Lopez type of game, and he still got caught, you know, in pick and roll situations. And whenever he was out in space defensively, it was an absolute nightmare. But again, to balance all that out, I was thoroughly impressed by some of the things he did on the offensive end.
Yeah, I mean, I've been more and more surprised by him all season long. I expected him to be the classic slow-moving stiff. The ball would bounce off his hands more times than not, that he wouldn't really have any moves other than, you know, some sort of awkward hook shot. And his hook shot, don't get me wrong, his hook shot looks awkward as can be, but he's really good with it. I mean, it goes in way more often than not. And he's got a lot of different drop steps and spin moves, and if you only make him dribble the ball once while making a move to the basket, I mean, I said it before, I think he's got a lot more offensive talent than people realize, to the point where I wouldn't say he's all that different from his brother.
Oh, come on. No, now you went too far.
What? Have you seen Brook Lopez play?
Of course I have.
He doesn't have a ton of offensive moves.
Well, okay, first of all, what centers in this league do have a ton of offensive moves? Hakeem Olajuwon and David Robinson left this league a while ago, but no, I mean, Brook is still unquestionably the better offensive player and has more options. But again, I mean, I thought Robin was nice. I still, you know, I still say that I care about, you know, what's going to happen in the playoffs. This is against a guy in Vucevic who, you know, is not a quality center in this league, at least yet, or, you know.
He was fairly impressive. I mean, I'm not disagreeing, but he was actually more impressive than I thought he was going to be.
Yeah, offensively, I mean, he definitely has some attributes. But, yeah, I don't want to take anything away from Robin Lopez's game. This, you know, should be commended. It's not easy to score 29 points in the NBA, regardless of your matchup, especially only on 10 shots. So I was really impressed. And then I want to go to this guy next just because I had a really, you know, good question that I think that you and I should answer from somebody on Twitter. So so Grievous Vasquez puts up 27 points. I mean, by far and away, those are the two leading scorers in this game and a victory. But overall, when you consider that basketball is played on both ends of the floor and that it involves a lot more than just raw stats, what grade would you give Vasquez in this game and why?
I would give Vasquez a B-. And, yeah, if you just look at his numbers, 27 points, 8 assists, 6 rebounds, a steal, 4 turnovers, he was the primary reason why Jameer Nelson went off like crazy throughout that game. And they were putting, they didn't actually do it in the first half so much, but Vasquez was still just having any sort of difficulty whenever they tried to push the ball. And Jameer Nelson was hounding him on defense so that his offense was, he couldn't get into his plays. This is something we've said a million times, but in the third, suddenly they just started running that pick and roll where they would bring Robin Lopez's guy over, and they were putting Vasquez and Lopez in a pick and roll every play, and it was embarrassing. Lopez, and except for one block by Lopez where he managed to stay in it, Lopez and Vasquez weren't even in the picture by the time Jameer Nelson was crossing the free throw line. That's how far behind, that's how slow they were. They weren't being able to contest him. It was dead off defensively. I was completely flabbergasted how, I mean, Jameer Nelson is fast, but he's not that fast.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. As I'm watching this game, I'm just thanking my lucky stars that you were the one doing the recap, because yeah. I didn't want to have to explain or justify my opinions on why I thought a guy who put up 27, 8, and 6 had, you know, just a slightly above average night at best. But I agree with everything you say.
Yeah, I mean, so you say it has to happen on both ends. And the way I look at this is, while Vasquez gave up a lot of points on his side, he also scored a lot of points, and he did it fairly efficiently, and he was okay offensively. So you kind of look at that and say, okay, this night he probably managed to have more of a positive impact than a negative impact. But, I mean, he was just getting torched on that pick and roll. And honestly, the reason why Ryan Anderson didn't play, you know, his usual 35, 36 minutes in this game was they had to pull Ryan Anderson and put in Anthony Davis to have anybody who was able to come over and quick enough and long enough to be able to help contest help-wise on those pick and rolls. Because, I mean, Jameer Nelson was exploding so fast past those two guys that Ryan Anderson was not quick enough to be able to get over and actually be able to contest it. The layups were that open. So they were like, okay, well, we got to get Anthony Davis back in there to give us some sort of hope in contesting this. If you have to adjust your entire lineup and get rid of one of your most potent offensive weapons to cover the defensive mistakes of two of your other players, it's a serious issue.
Yeah, I mean, that's just something that they're going to have to do with Vasquez on the floor, unless, I mean, Gordon is back, but they would probably have to get at least one more quality perimeter defender. But he's a guy that you have to hide on the defensive end. And again, going back to the playoffs, their high level of competition, you could do that when you have a guy like Steve Nash, who both Dallas and Phoenix had to hide for years, or even Phoenix would take Sean Marion and put him on Nash's guy. And, you know, that's worth it at that level. But with a guy like Vasquez, you know, it's going to be hard to do when you get to that level. But so here's the question. And I think our current evaluation of Lopez and Vasquez are more than fair. I think you and I both maintain that Lopez is a good third big, a great fourth big on a good team. And he's maybe a guy who could be a starter on a handful of teams.
Mm-hmm.
Grievous Vasquez is a bottom tier starting point guard, top tier backup point guard.
Yes.
So the question that I was asked, and I want to get your, I guess, your reasoning back first before I give mine, but was essentially asked, you know, a lot of times we come on here and we kind of excuse the mistakes of guys like Rivers or Davis or Anderson, whatever, and say that once X, Y, and Z happens, they're only going to get better. And, you know, it's basically excused for now, but we don't really, I don't remember us ever talking about, well, you know, when Lopez and Vasquez get better, I mean, we almost assume that they're pretty much at their highest level, where other people seem to tend to believe, well, now they're just finally getting it and they're going to get even better and better as the years go on. Do you disagree with that they're going to, you know, continue to get better and better? And if so, why don't you see them having that same kind of potential to grow 200, 300% as you do with some of the other players on this roster?
In general, I feel that a player's athletic gifts always put a ceiling on their abilities. And I don't feel that Robin Lopez and Grievous Vasquez have the athletic gifts that are going to allow them to advance much further than where they are. And I'm not saying that neither of them can improve. I believe that both of them have things that they could improve on. I mean, both of them will probably get better at shooting. Every NBA player does. I believe that Vasquez will probably figure out even a few more crafty dribble moves that'll get him open or get him that little bit of space he needs to get off those really odd one-handed layups that he puts through the hoop so effectively. They will add a few minor things to their game that will help them, but they're not going to make leaps. They're not going to suddenly get it and be different from what they are now. They're going to be version 1.1 instead of version 2.0. That's just my take on both of these players. Because Robin Lopez isn't suddenly going to get much more athletic. He's not going to suddenly be able to jump higher. He's not going to be able to move his feet quicker. He's not going to be able to rebound the ball harder. Maybe he'll get a little stronger. That might help him a little bit. But I'm not sure that will, because it's his speed that's his issue right now. And you can't improve somebody's speed. You really can't.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think that their ceiling is completely limited by, you know, specifically their lateral movement or lack thereof. And
I feel the same way about, like, Lance Thomas. I don't expect Lance Thomas to improve greatly from where he is.
Right.
Now, I will say this about Austin. You brought Austin Rivers specifically. I'm not convinced Austin Rivers has a really high athletic level. I think he's fine. I don't think he's going to be. So I'm not sure how great he can be become because, I mean, his handle's already amazing. He can learn a lot of different ways to shoot and finish, but I don't know if he's ever going to have the athletic gifts to make him a star guard at all, or even like a surefire starter in the league. Anthony Davis clearly has every athletic gift in the world and can become anything he sets his mind to become and works at.
Yeah, and I mean, there's even different levels. Like, I mean, with Ryan Anderson, I think we've seen improvements in his game and him being able to use his handle more to get himself to spaces and take different kinds of shots. And there's a fluidity that Lopez definitely doesn't have that I think limits his ceiling. And Vasquez, I think it's a combination of lack of athleticism and the fact that he's just at a position that is probably more loaded than it's ever been in the history of the NBA. And there's only so high, you know, so far up that rung he could climb, because as he's getting better, so is Russell Westbrook and Derrick Rose and, you know, all of these other super elite point guards ahead of him are on par. Kyrie Irving is getting better. You know, all these guys that are young that have this fantastic athleticism and, you know, the skill sets that somebody like Vasquez has. So, I don't know. I wanted to at least give our takes on that because, you know, I could see if I was a big Vasquez or Lopez fan where I think that we're being unfair in kind of limiting their ceiling, but that's at least how I see it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best you could hope for either of those guys is a David West sort of progression. So David West, after his second year as a starter, he didn't really change all that much. He made a leap as starter from his first year, where he was almost solely a jump shooter. He didn't do a whole lot else. And his second year, where he started throwing in that post game that we all knew and loved so much. But from that point on, he added something every year, but you didn't really see it. I mean, it didn't like impact his stat line. It just eliminated a few things here and there, and it was just like a small improvement that made him a little bit better defensively or a little bit better offensively. Like, he used to have this really annoying tendency to pump fake, take a step before he dribbled, and get called for traveling. And he'd do that almost once a game for most of the season. And next year he came back and he never made that mistake. He had worked on it. He'd figured out how to do that pump fake, then dribble before he moved, and he ingrained it in his game.
Yeah,
it helped a little bit, but it wasn't like a huge leap. He wasn't suddenly, oh, David West's an all-star now.
Yeah, I mean, oh, he was twice, but
I know, but that's, yeah. I mean,
no, he wasn't. He wasn't one of those no-brainer surefire. Yeah, and I think Vasquez is more likely to maybe be that type than Lopez. And one thing that I see Vasquez starting to do a lot, but he's not good at it yet. But you could see if he improves in this area him really, you know, helping the team out a lot more is they're putting him in the post on offense. Mm-hmm. And this is where, like, I think Vasquez's ceiling could be later career Andre Miller. Like, not the faster Andre Miller that led the NBA in assists in his prime, but later career would take guys, you know, these smaller point guards, the ones that are quicker than him, down into the post, you know, could grab some rebounds when he went down there and also be a good enough spot up shooter. I think if Vasquez really works, that's where I would have him work, especially with Gordon coming back. It looks like his spot up's good, but I really think he could do a lot of interesting things if he could get a post game down to where teams, you know, would have to double from time to time, or he drew the opponent's attention and was able to pass out of it. So I could see them getting better, but yeah, they're not going to get, you know, huge leaps and bounds better, but just something I figured we'd address. So
let's talk about the one guy who I felt his stat line completely belied his impact in the game. So Austin Rivers in this game shot 2 of 7, missed his only three-pointer, got no free throws, which is unusual for him. 3 rebounds, 3 assists, 1 steal, 4 points. Did that stat line really, to you, explain what his impact in that game was?
It's hard to say because he had 3 quarters where he did almost nothing. But I will ask anybody to go back, if you still have it on DVR or if you have League Pass and you could go back and watch a game, to go back and watch that 3rd quarter and tell me he's not by far the best Hornet on the court in that 3rd quarter. So I think that's where it's a little unbalanced, because he went into halftime. He didn't even take a shot the
right.
First half. Then he comes out in the second half, and the first possession, he takes a shot, drives in, makes a layup. You could tell Monty said something to him at halftime. And then he was also on the ball a lot, got a lot of nice kick-out assists, you know, a couple of which to McGuire, which got him going.
Yep.
So that 3rd quarter where the Hornets kind of blew it open, where it was a close game and got a 10-point lead, Rivers was absolutely phenomenal. But in the first half, he barely touched the ball. Vasquez dominated it. And then in the 4th quarter, Vasquez dominated again, so he was nowhere to be found. But in that stretch where they put the ball in his hands, he was magnificent in that 3rd quarter.
Yep. I mean, that was my whole take on it, too, was he was completely quiet. He wasn't getting the ball. I mean, there's 2 pieces here. When he did get the ball, he basically might make a move and then swing it, or he might just swing it. Frequently he was just planted in the corner and he didn't do anything. But right in that 3rd quarter, when he was basically, there was a stretch there where he was asked to be the primary ball handler. And it was after Vasquez had some trouble in the 2nd quarter under pressure. They basically came out in the 3rd quarter and said, Rivers, you're the point guard. As far as I could, that's what it seemed like to me. And Rivers had a little run there where he was looking really good. I mean, does that negate the fact that he was pretty much completely quiet the rest of the game? Probably not. But there was at least one stretch in that game where he looked like he could be an NBA player, absolutely, out there. So that was good to see. Because we're not going to be saying that very much for the rest of this week's games.
Yeah, and see, that's one of my problems with Vasquez. Again, Vasquez lovers, don't kill me, and just, you know, balancing out the good with the bad. But, you know, you hear Chris Paul in any interview when they talk about, you know, the philosophy of his game and what he likes to do. And he says, you know, 1st quarter, first half, I love to get guys on my team touches, get their confidence going, because I know that later in the game I'll have the ball in my hand and I could get mine if I want. But I love to get other guys involved and get them into the game, you know, mentally. And I don't understand how, as Vasquez, you have, you know, this 20-year-old rookie on your team who, when he has good games, you know, the Hornets play a lot better, and Vasquez doesn't make a conscious effort to get him the ball or even get Davis the ball, you know, in easy opportunities. It's just, that doesn't seem to be part of his, you know, of what he wants to do in the first half of games. And again, I know we were spoiled by Chris Paul, but this is even something that David Wesley talked about when he made his transition to point guard. The first thing he, you know, was always conscious of is, okay, am I feeding my guys? Am I getting them into this game? You know, so they'll be able to play with focus on both ends. And I just don't understand how, as a point guard, you don't get your starting shooting guard one shot in an entire first half.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm going to have more to say on Vasquez and his acumen running the pick and roll when we get to Eric Gordon, because I think if people saw that game with Eric Gordon, I can draw some very good parallels between the two of those, Vasquez and Gordon, and what the differences are that makes, I mean, you can't say Vasquez, there's no way I would ever say Vasquez is selfish, but the limitations of his game make him unable to spread the wealth as much as you'd like. So we'll get to that when Gordon arrives on the scene in just two more games.
All right, so I know we want to get to it, so let's move forward. Toronto game, it was kind of a foreshadowing in a way in that Toronto got one of their star guards back just in time to play us. And I know that he was the difference in this game. I mean, I just came away from this game, you know, happy that Anthony Davis really came out like a monster in the fourth quarter. That was my biggest Hornets takeaway. The biggest Raptors takeaway by far was that Kyle Lowry is still the player that, you know, he was last year and the year before, even though Toronto's record with him as a starting point guard is less than stellar.
Getting away from that game, I just want to say this one thing about Brian Colangelo, who is the GM of the Toronto Raptors. I have never seen a guy in the NBA who has a higher level of cognitive dissonance than Brian Colangelo. The guy has gotten, he settles on an idea about what players he has, and then just refuses any sort of evidence that disproves the theory at all. I mean, I don't know how you can be sitting there, and this is based on what I've heard about the rumors about what Toronto is saying. The first evidence is Andre Bargnani. He has never been a good player. He's had a few seasons where he shot fairly well, but not great. He's never been able to rebound. He's never been able to defend. He's never been able to pass. He doesn't block. He doesn't steal. He doesn't do jack except for shoot the ball. And then sometimes he's okay at it. This isn't like a Dirk Nowitzki comparison, because Dirk could actually hit his shots. Bargnani's never proven except for one season that he could hit him at a high level. And still this guy gets huge, huge contract deals. Jose Calderon has proved year after year he is not really a starting point guard. You know, he's a little bit better than Vasquez because his passing is better and his deep shooting has proven to be better, and he's low turnover. But he's never been proven to be a surefire starting top 15 kind of point guard. And now this team is talking about how, oh, well, we need to have Jose Calderon start. And we're not really sure about that Kyle Lowry guy, because Kyle Lowry was out with an injury and we won some games and Jose Calderon was starting and now we're winning. Ignoring the fact that Andre Bargnani was not sucking up 20 shots a game, sucking up the court. I mean, how is this even something that you could say with a straight face?
Yeah.
Brian Colangelo's an idiot, and if he's actually putting Kyle Lowry on the market right now because he thinks Jose Calderon is his answer, then every person in the league should be calling up trying to take advantage of that. I mean, because Kyle Lowry's like five times the player Jose Calderon is.
So you would give up Vasquez in our 2013 unprotected first rounder for Kyle Lowry?
How long is Kyle Lowry's contract? I don't know that.
He's got one more year after this year at about 6.5. So you'd have him for this year, then next year at 6.5, and then you'd have to re-sign him.
I would do that probably.
Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, he was He was a beast. The surprise out of nowhere that always attacks the Hornets. I'll admit, like, I scout the draft every year. I think I know every player in the NBA. I was scratching my head trying to remember who Allen Anderson was. I had no idea. I thought I had him. Is he the guy that played for the Hawks a while back? I thought that Anderson was from, no, that Anderson was from Indiana. I forget that one's name. Leave it on the comments section for those who have time to Google or just remember off the top of their heads. Or actually, Eric Gordon would probably know. But yeah,
Allen Anderson's been around for a while, though. I recognize the name.
I know, but there was another.
He's 30 years old.
Yeah, and he hasn't. He came back into the league last year, but was out of the league for, you know, 4.5 years. But yeah, there's your guy out of nowhere that we have to have every game that hurts the Hornets. I mean, he scores 16, but he also was just in Ryan Anderson's jersey all night. I actually think he did us a favor with that double technical that he and Ryan Anderson got, kind of got Anderson fired up, turned it on late in that game. But
I loved Ryan Anderson in his headbutt.
Yeah, but I mean, was it me or were the refs calling this game as if DeMar DeRozan was Kevin Durant?
Yeah, DeRozan was getting bailed out frequently, and that's the only reason why he was efficient. The announcers in that game were talking about DeRozan like he was like the best mid-range shooter to ever step foot on the floor. And he was kind of, 9 of 22. We're not talking like an amazing shooter here. This is standard for him.
Yeah.
And if he hadn't gotten 13 freaking free throws, then he would have had a pretty standard, ordinary game for himself.
So here we go. This is all I got to say about this game and the Hornets having any chance this year of, being the 600% win team that I think most fans think we are if we're healthy. 49 minutes played, 3 points, 6 rebounds, 3 assists, 8 fouls. Those are the numbers from our quartet of small forwards.
Yeah.
In an entire game of action, 3 points, 6 rebounds, 3 assists, and 8 fouls. That, I mean, it's, I've, as a Hornets fan, I've lived through some bad shooting guards. I mean, I remember a season when Pete Myers was essentially the starter all year. I've seen Devin Brown get way too much playing time. I've seen some bad shooting guards. This quartet and just these small forwards in general, I'll go out and say the worst position in total for a Hornets team ever, even worse than the Dan Dickow and whoever was his backup, point guard unit on your favorite Hornets team ever.
Yeah, I mean, Lee Nalen was small forward for that team, and he was the team's leading scorer.
I mean,
14.5 a game or something like that.
It's bad. I know we came into the season thinking that point guard was going to be, a big part that held us down, and just guards in general. This small forward unit is not only the worst in the NBA, but it's not even close. There's a huge disparity between 29th and 30th in this area. It's unbelievable. There's nothing there.
Yeah. I mean, Xavier Henry, we've said everything we need to see about him. I could not see Xavier Henry play. If he played 0 minutes for the rest of the season, I'm happy with that. I don't think he has earned anything, and I don't think he's shown me anything that prove otherwise. Lance Thomas, we've talked about this at the beginning of the season. He gives so much energy and produces so little out of it in the end because he's just so overmatched. And he has to, and it put it in the small forward position is even worse because he just has to foul. He can't stay in front of some of these guys. He had 5 fouls in that game. I mean, if I had to select one of these small forwards to play, I don't know if I would be picking Dominic McGuire or Aminu over one or the other. I mean, Aminu's at least going to give me some rebounding. That's something positive. Dominic Meyer's going to give me some defense. I don't know if it's great defense. It's adequate defense. So which is better, great rebounding from the small forward position or adequate defense? That's the poison that Monty gets to pick every night with this team.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
My rotation would be Dominique McGuire would be my starting small forward, and Gravis Vasquez would be my backup.
And honestly, you know what I would – I mean, if I was Monty, I would be – if I have as little confidence in Darius Miller as he seems to have, and I'd like to see Darius Miller get some minutes, like some long minutes, just to see what he could do at this point, because he can't be worse. He really can't be. I would just walk into Dell Demps' office and say, look, you know the D-League. Get me the best small forward they have there. I don't care, you know, what he does. Just as long as he does something okay that could be possibly NBA ready, bring him here. I'll play him long minutes. We'll see what we got.
Yeah, his name would have been Chris Douglas Roberts, but.
No, but you get a. Chris Douglas Roberts is a head case, so maybe not if they're a head case. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. The small forward position is still like a gaping wound. I mean, if you look at our starting lineup, if you're assuming Ryan Anderson comes off the bench, we have an slightly below average center, a below average point guard, a up and coming power forward who's probably about average starter, a little bit above average starter right now, a supremely good shooting guard if he plays, and probably the 50th best small forward in the league starting. And I'm probably being kind when I say the 50th best small forward.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, we have six NBA players on this team. Maybe, I mean, and on Austin Rivers is below average replacement. So, I mean, that's why I don't even count him yet. I think there are six guys on this team that should legitimately be getting minutes in the NBA. But even with Eric Gordon back, imagine the whole team's full and completely healthy. There's 40 to 60 minutes going to guys who have no business playing in an NBA game every night. And then if the Hornets have one or two injuries, that could balloon to 80 to 100 minutes that you have to give to guys who just have no business playing right now in the league and would get absolutely no time on a legitimate playoff contender.
I'll agree 100% with that. If we were doing the NBA rank that would happen this offseason, you're right. There would only be six players on this team that I would rank higher than, say, 350.
Right. So, I mean, you think if there's 30 teams, most teams go with the nine-man rotation. Mm-hmm. Top 270 players should be getting minutes in the NBA. And, yeah, I think we have six guys firmly in there. And then our seventh best player, I wouldn't believe would crack the top 300.
Yeah, our seventh best player would probably be what? Brian Roberts? Maybe Austin Rivers? I don't know if I'd say that.
It would depend on what you need. I mean, Rivers or Mason, I think it would be one of those two. As we saw in the Charlotte game, you know, when they went zone, Mason was more valuable than Rivers, but, you know, Rivers does have the skill set to get to the basket and did some decent things in the Toronto game, but and like we already talked about in the Orlando game, you know, had nice minute. And that's something that we might see. I mean, maybe with him only getting 12 minutes instead of 31, maybe he'll just be able to play those entire 12 minutes the way we saw in the Orlando game, or maybe he's on the ball and, you know, maybe the pressure's off. So I still don't think we've seen him in the role that he should be playing as a rookie. So, but as of right now, from what we've seen, we have six guys on this roster, even when the roster is completely healthy, that should be playing minutes at the NBA. And that means you've got to give almost a whole game's worth of minutes to guys who just are going to hurt you 9 out of 10 games.
Okay, so now that we've ripped our small forwards apart and discarded them, this game, who was your MVP?
I mean,
for the Hornets.
Yeah. No, to me, that fourth quarter, Anthony Davis came back with a little over 9 minutes left in the fourth quarter. It looked to me like Toronto was starting to pull away and had that game. And he just came in with a completely different attitude, spring in his step, ferocity. Like, he was so incredible in that fourth quarter in every way. And again, to me, it's not just about results. It's about, you know, the effort and the things that went into producing those results. That fourth quarter, to me, was the most impressive stretch I've ever seen Anthony Davis have. And you know, he was a big part of the reason why they got back into that game. So I'd have to say Anthony Davis.
Yeah, I'll accept Anthony Davis as a good choice. 25 points, 9 rebounds, 3 blocks. I gotta say, I've seen more blocks from Anthony Davis than he keeps getting credit for. It's starting to annoy me. And it may just be that I'm watching guys adjust their shots so dramatically that I just think they've been blocked. But he has this knack of jumping straight up in the air, and his arms are so long and he leaps so high that he can block guys who are like, feel like they're 15 feet away from him.
Yeah, and the blocks and steals, I mean, those are the numbers that show up on the stat sheet, but, and I actually think you did a good job talking about this in the Orlando game, but his ability to just take up space with perimeter defense, whether he's switching onto a guard or just hedging and showing on screens or just, you know, that wingspan of his, he creates so many problems on the perimeter as a defender. None of those things show up in the stat sheet, but he clogs up passing lanes. He gets in the way where, you know, the other big men on this team just look absolutely horrible when they're in the pick and roll. So it's a lot of things that don't even show up on the stat sheet that just impresses me and where he makes such a dramatic impact on the game as overall.
Yeah, you brought up the Orlando game, and there was a bunch of different times where they ended up started running different switches, and Anthony Davis kept getting switched out on Jameer Nelson. And I'm not going to say that Anthony Davis is a magnificent defender of a fast guard. I mean, he's adequate. But I was feeling so much better having Anthony Davis end up on Jameer Nelson, because what happens then is nobody's in a pick and roll. Nobody's stumbling over each other trying to defend it. It's not Vasquez and Lopez or Vasquez and somebody else or Lopez and somebody else who they're conflicting with each other because they're both kind of slow-footed and they're not really getting where they need to be. Because what happens is every guard in the league, when they get ISO'd on a big man, is like, I could take this guy. And so they always call an ISO for themselves. And Anthony Davis defending an ISO against almost every guard in the league, I'm just kind of hoping they take that pull-up jumper, because he's going to be so close to them and so quickly because of his arms that it's a bad shot for them.
Yeah, I mean, my only fear in that situation, though, is that Davis is by far the best defender. I mean, sorry, the best rebounder.
Right.
And now you've got, first of all, you have Lopez down there as the lone big, but then also if the Hornets have switched, you've got whatever guard switched onto Davis's big man down low. So even if he gets them to take bad shots, you know, we don't really have another rebounder while he's out on the perimeter. So
Vasquez, I will say, does do a very nice job when he gets switched on to big men of holding them back. And it's because Vasquez is a pretty good big guy himself. I think he does a fairly decent job there. But you're right. I mean, I'm not, like I said, it's not an ideal situation. I would much prefer we had a speedy guard on the perimeter who could actually try to stay in front of the guy, and a big who could hedge a little better on the inside, and they're not running pick and rolls where both of our guys or one of our guys is limited. So I just always felt better when Anthony Davis ended up being ISO'd, and it just seemed to me like this was going to be a better outcome. Again, Grievous Vasquez, 42 minutes. So he's been sucking up minutes like crazy. Now, this was an overtime game, but still 42 minutes. And again, you look at the stat line, 20 points, 9 rebounds, 14 assists. I mean, I want to go ask Vasquez why he's doing this to me. I mean, this is like the stat line that's you look at and say, he's amazing. But again, he had 6 turnovers, And while he just torched Jorge Calderon, as soon as Kyle Lowry came on the floor, Vasquez could get nothing done. I mean, he was shut down. There was nowhere he was going. He couldn't dribble the ball anywhere. It was ridiculously bad watching him play basketball.
Yeah, and Monty knew this was coming. I thought it was hilarious. In the first quarter when Lowry came in, Monty brought Roberts in. In the third quarter when Lowry came in, Vasquez came out, Roberts came in. You know, Monty was hiding Vasquez from Lowry as much as he could until the end of the game came, and, you know, he obviously couldn't do it anymore. He needed Vasquez on the court. And there was a couple times when Lowry got stuck on the picks and Vasquez would just explode and get to the basket and take a shot. But you saw on that, you know, kind of one of the final plays of the game where Vasquez was looking to take the lead with the Hornets down one, Lowry just went under the pick, got right in front of Vasquez, and Vasquez couldn't get up that shot that, you know, he's been hitting almost all year. And it was just, it's a horrible matchup. It's a horrible matchup for almost anybody, but I think it's maybe the worst possible matchup that you could have for Vasquez is putting Kyle Lowry on him. But he sure wrecked. He sure stacked up his numbers when Calderon was in the game.
Yeah. Calderon had a really bad game. I was watching him like kind of special because we keep talking about maybe trading for him because he is such a good at controlling the game, and he looked awful.
Yeah, I mean that's the exception, not the norm. He's been great coming in as a starter and just overall in the year. But Vasquez got stuck on that 9 rebound number because he had that right around halftime. Yep. And didn't get another one for his triple-double, but...
And you know what surprises me about that? Usually when somebody has, like, 9 rebounds, they're aware of it. I mean, they're told by somebody on the bench, and their teammates make sure they get that 10th rebound. Vasquez must not care, which I like.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, it was one of those games where Lopez, of course, of all nights, goes out and snatches 8 rebounds, so... That
it's Lopez's fault.
That leaves one less opportunity for Vasquez. But
one less? Don't you mean 5 less opportunities for Vasquez?
What so you asked me the question of who I thought the MVP was, and then said that Davis was acceptable, as if you had somebody else in mind. Did you have somebody else in mind for that?
Ryan Anderson. I thought he was pretty big in that fourth quarter.
Yeah.
I mean, if we hadn't had his shooting and his rebounding, I mean, he was crashing the boards hard. I don't think we would have won that. But, I mean, it was nice. I like getting these minutes with Ryan Anderson and Anthony Davis out there. I still think that's by far our best lineup. And so
let me ask you this before we move on to the game everybody wants to hear about. We want to talk about last thing, imagine you hadn't seen anything else this season or the past or whatever, just in this game and this game alone. If this was the first game you had ever watched, do you think you would have watched the matchup between Aaron Gray and Robin Lopez and thought, geez, one of these guys is definitely way better than the other? They're about the same. One is slightly better. I mean, what did you take away from this matchup of the Titans?
I would not have said one was way better than the other, but I would have thought Aaron Gray was a better defensive player than Robin Lopez.
Wow.
And that Aaron Gray was able to, because when Aaron Gray was on Lopez couldn't get anything done. That was when Lopez started falling apart offensively.
Yeah.
Do you disagree?
No, I mean, I just think it's, I mean, the things that I had to read after Robin Lopez had 29 points just two nights before, about, you know, now he has a 21 point whatever per, and he's should be in consideration as an all-star. Like, just coming off of that to seeing a game in which I thought that those guys played pretty much to a draw, you know, was just too much for my mind to take this week.
Yeah. All right, so let's move on to the next game, unless you wanted to talk about, you know, Al-Farouq Aminu's four minutes and 3 fouls.
And nothing else at all.
Nothing else. All zero.
Let's move on to the game that I can honestly say we've all been waiting for 4 to 6 weeks. Oh, I mean 8 weeks.
Right. Eric Gordon's return started the game on the bench with Austin Rivers, starting, and that flipped pretty quickly. Although I will say this, I kind of didn't believe that he was only going to play 25 minutes like they said before the game. And dead on the nose, Eric Gordon, 25 minutes, 13 shots, 6 three-pointers, 14 free throw attempts. And those all combined for 24 points. He had 7 assists, 0 rebounds, which is also an Eric Gordon signature. People don't be surprised by that. I had a couple nice steals, and he had a couple turnovers, which is to be expected when he has the ball in his hands as much as he did in the fourth quarter. I was really expecting him to struggle more than he did. I mean, he was clearly winded at the end of the game. I mean, it looked like he was gasping for air when he stepped up to the line a couple times for free throws. But did you expect the kind of explosion he was showing in that game?
I guess I kind of did, just because of all the talk of his rehab. I mean, it's not like the guy had been resting the last couple of weeks. He had been, you know, going through, you know, nearly 6 hours of rehab a day and was working really hard. So I thought that in spurts, yeah, we'd see that explosion. But I think you're being kind to saying that he got winded at the end of the game. I mean, he was winded in that first quarter after a couple of drives. And he was making a very conscious effort to not spend any energy. I mean, his first two possessions on the court, he did not touch the ball one time. Then he gets it on the third possession and just drives right to the hole. A nice little bank shot. But, I mean, he was really, if he wasn't involved in a play on an offense, he was just biding his time and walking around and really not getting into it. But when it was time to make a move and step up, I mean, he was the same explosive player. And it was, 4 of those free throws came at the end of the game when, you know, the Hornets were being fouled, but still, 10 free throws in essentially 24 minutes. He has 24 points and he had 7 assists, but 5 of those assists were for 3-pointers.
Yep.
So he has 19 points off of his assists, meaning that he essentially directly contributed to 43 points over 25 minutes in a game that looked like was getting away from the Hornets. And, obviously they came back and won. So I say he goes out right now. I mean, his PER for the season, it's 41.1. That would be the highest of all time. Just go out on top.
Just shut it down.
Yeah.
That's actually pretty funny. So there, I don't know. There's a whole bunch of things I wanted to say about Eric Gordon in that game. I actually thought that two of the fouls that he drew when he went to the basket were kind of fouls that if I was a Charlotte Bobcat fan, I would be screaming, "That's not a foul!" But on both of them, we had putbacks immediately. So it was like he got fouled. Our guys dunked the ball as the whistle went off. So, I just thought that was – that right there is a great indicator, because he's going to the hole, and we have guys like Anthony Davis and even Lopez. As much as we murder him as a rebounder, he's not a bad offensive rebounder if he's following an attacking guard. I mean, both of those guys would have had we would have had those points regardless because of what Eric Gordon was doing out there. That alone is worth tremendous. And you talked about this at the beginning of the season when you knew Austin Rivers' primary ability was driving to the basket, maybe getting some free throws, or at least creating the penetration, and the idea of having him with Eric Gordon. I mean, watching Eric Gordon, what he did to that Charlotte defense, and first up, we do need to say that have a grain of salt here. The Charlotte defense is not a good one. I mentioned in the preview, it's the worst defense in the league. But what he was doing to that defense, even if he missed those shots, we had it would be 50-50 at the worst for us to get the rebound and put it back.
Yeah, and all I kept thinking about was, because David Wesley said this, you've said it, Jerry V has come on here and said it, is that it was nice to see a guard moving forward on the offensive end. I mean, he would get the ball, maybe wait for a screen, but then he would attack, and that's just something we haven't seen. And I mean, I really thought about it. If, let's say, we removed Eric Gordon for this from this team, and if I was just able to go across the NBA landscape and pick any player in the entire NBA that would complement this roster because of the things they bring to it. And obviously LeBron and Durant are out there because we desperately need a small forward. After that, it was like Harden and Eric Gordon. I mean, basically Eric Gordon would be in the top 5 to 7 as far as just pure skill sets in the entire NBA that complement this current Hornets roster. And you just saw how he affected so many other dimensions of the game, you know, specifically Vasquez, and just allowing him to play in that second half the type of game that he should be playing, where he spots up or, you know, gets his penetration after, you know, Gordon already kind of has the defense moving side to side.
Yeah. I would say Chris Paul, but, you know, that's me being Chris Paul homer.
We already have Vasquez.
That's right.
You put Chris Paul on this team with the shooting guards and small forwards that we have, that might be tough. But anyway,
he's played with some pretty crappy ones in a Hornets uniform. He'd be used to it.
Yeah, this would be an all-time worst. But anyway, just two things that I got to get off my chest before we go more into the evaluation. One, it'll be the last time I say it. I want to try to root for this team, and me wishing that Gordon gets traded is not going to help the team. It's not going to make it more likely to happen. For all those who want to know, yes, I would still trade him today because I still believe that he will be an injury-prone player throughout his career. I'm hoping to be wrong, but my personal philosophy on, you know, how I would be a GM, yes, I would be trying to trade him, especially if he has a couple more games like this and builds his level up. And the second thing is, nobody needs to read, see, this is the player that, you know, Eric Gordon is when he's healthy, as if anybody was bashing him because of, you know, his ability to play the game of basketball. Everybody recognizes how phenomenal he is on that end. You know, Mason and I worked hard on a piece and of how he would probably impact this team, and that all came to light. So I have absolutely no doubt that he's a phenomenal player. I have no problems with the Phoenix comments. I still would trade him for that reason, but I'm not going to talk about that on this podcast anymore. Just try to move forward with him on the team, and if it happens, I'll evaluate it. But for now, I'm just going to evaluate Eric Gordon, the player, and not get hung up on all that other stuff.
So no apologies to Eric Gordon, huh?
No, because I would still trade him. I would still take him today.
Yeah. I mean, and these kinds of games are going to make it really tough to swallow if it happens. Because, you know, these games are, it's so enjoyable watching that kind of offense.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, our defense was still pretty poor. I mean, in the fourth quarter, we weren't getting stops, but our offense was clicking, and it was gorgeous to watch. So here I'm going to pull out the difference between having Vasquez and Gordon being the primary ball handler, and kind of try to say what the difference is here, why Vasquez still gets really nice assist numbers, but they're of a different quality. When Vasquez is trying to drive, and it's always on a pick and roll, Vasquez, you know, only rarely goes one-on-one with a guy. Vasquez is so slow that his entire focus has to be on one option. If you watch Vasquez drive, the big man is going to be able to keep up with him. The guard is going to be able to trace him and shadow him one direction. And a pick and roll isn't just a pick. The word pick and roll is kind of misleading. You're not running a pick and roll to get one guy, either the roll man or the pick man, a shot. You're actually usually spreading the floor to get all the guys on the wings shot. But it's so slow to develop when Vasquez is running it that the other spots can be covered. And in general, the only thing left to Vasquez is that pocket pass to the rolling big man or his own shot, which is why he gets a lot of shots in games. He doesn't have all those other options. The guys will stay home on the wings. They have plenty of time to get back out there because it just takes so long to get over the guy who's picking. Then you go and you watch Eric. So, I mean, Vasquez will get assists because they have to decide. The pick and rolls decide. So the one guy is left between them and the basket. He has to decide, do I guard Vasquez closely or do I guard Lopez or whoever he's pick and rolling with? So one of those two shots will probably be there. And so he's either going to get an assist or he's going to get a shot. When we watched Eric Gordon in that game, he was so quick, so explosive, he could split the defenders if he needed to. He didn't have to go all the way around either way, or he could actually go away from the pick and explode into the paint at times, that there wasn't enough time for everybody to get where they needed to be, to guard the wing players, to collapse in the paint. So people, whenever someone does pick and roll, everybody collapses into the paint to defend it. With Vasquez, they can then get back out to their guys. With Eric Gordon, they have no chance. So every time he flashed into that mid area where he's almost to the free throw line, he would have one or two shooters open. He'd usually have, if it was Jason Smith or Lopez or even Anthony Davis, that guy was somewhat open so he could hit a pick and pop if he had to, or he had a clear lane to the basket. So instead of it being one option or a shot, it was really three options or two options and a shot, which makes your life so much more easy. And even Ryan Anderson had said it after the game. It had been a long time since he'd had open shots like that in a game. And Gordon is really good at figuring out what he needs to do. He got into that space, and he could just fire it off to Vasquez or to Anderson or figure out what shot he could take if he had a Euro step move open to him. It's unbelievably different. So, yes, Vasquez can run a pick and roll and be successful because he is a good enough passer and he is a good enough shooter to be able to make something out of it. But it's still, your options are way more limited than if you have Eric Gordon running it.
Yeah, I think this team is going to be really fun to watch. I think everybody kind of slides into their roles. I mean, yeah, it must be so nice for Ryan Anderson to have been able to catch that ball in the corner, which, first of all, we haven't seen many corner threes, and it's a big part of what you just talked about, of Vasquez can't really get the ball out to the corner three, so Anderson hasn't been set up there. But now with Gordon running the pick and roll, Anderson could be out in the corner, but it must have been so nice for him to catch the ball and have nobody, you know, within 5 to 10 feet of him in this game, and I think that's going to continue. Vasquez gets the slide into his role. We'll see what happens with Rivers. I think, you know, before we just give the proper due to the stars, I think two people that really haven't gotten enough credit for this game, one, and they're tied to each other, but it's Roger Mason and Monty Williams. Monty saw at halftime that Charlotte was playing a lot of zone. He puts Austin Rivers on the bench at halftime, puts Roger Mason in for him, starting shooting guard. And Roger Mason goes 4 for 4 in that third quarter from three. And without that happening, without Mason hitting a couple of threes and bringing the Hornets into the game, I don't even know if Gordon gets his full 25 minutes if the Hornets are, you know, down 20 points at the end of the third, and, you know, it's obvious that they're going to lose. I think Mason brought the Hornets back into that game for Eric Gordon to help win it, and, you know, that's a decision that Monty went with, and I think both of those guys deserve more credit than they're getting so far for the win in that game.
Yeah, but and I mean, Roger Mason, I think he only had one of those shots created for him. I mean, the other ones he caught, made a move, or, you know, one of them he was just outright covered and he still drilled it. So yeah, Mason really did have a big impact in that game. And I mean, part of that, just having him out there also helps when Eric Gordon is breaking, going off of those pick and rolls, because I mean, that is a completely spread floor. Roger Mason, Ryan Anderson, Grievous Vasquez. I mean, which of those guys do you help off of to try to stop Eric Gordon, who's driving to the basket, or Anthony Davis, who's rolling to the basket? That's what their poisons were in the fourth quarter. Which of those do you choose?
Yeah, I mean, that's what a real NBA team should look like. I mean, there's a reason why going into this week, the Hornets were 5-22, because they don't have the players that a real NBA team should have to make a difference. So now they finally do, and it is really enjoyable watching them. But I mean, how do you think? I think a lot of this was matchup based in the fact that the Hornets were down and Charlotte was playing zone, but I think it'll probably be another week before Gordon gets back to the 34, 36 minutes. But once he does, imagining that the Hornets are 100% healthy, how do you see those guard minutes playing out? And remember that we saw a lot of, three guard in this game, and I think we might see more of it.
I think that's exactly what we're going to see. I think Grievous Vasquez's minutes will come down a little bit. But what we saw in this game, I fully expect Xavier Henry to vanish from the lineup. Roger Mason will be out there based on whether or not they needed his shooting or not. I don't expect Austin Rivers to get more than 20 in any game, honestly.
So, okay, let's just go the three then. Rivers, Roberts, and Mason. How do you think, on average, let's say that Vasquez and Gordon are getting 72. So you have the 24 at guard, and then however many other at small forward. How would you see Rivers, Mason, and Roberts' minutes on an average day?
I don't expect to see Brian Roberts getting more than 6 to 8 minutes a game.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really think that he'll only come out there. I expect to see Monty Williams running a three-man rotation, Vasquez, Rivers, and Gordon as the primary ball handlers, with Brian Roberts if he needs somebody to steady things. If things are not working with Austin, they're not working with Grievous, he'll throw Brian Roberts out there to give him some minutes and try to keep things going in a positive direction. I fully expect to see Roger Mason become our de facto small forward, provided that it's not a matchup that's going to be an absolute disaster. The only reason why we were able to get away with that in this game was Michael Kidd-Gilchrist was playing power forward for a lot of the game. I mean, there's no problem putting Roger Mason Jr. on Gerald Henderson, who's a fine player, but he's not quick, or even Hakeem Warrick, who is a string bean and not all that powerful. And you see what happens when Hakeem Warrick has that. You know, Roger Mason was guarding him for a lot of that fourth quarter, and Hakeem Warrick had 10 rebounds in the game, which is not a Hakeem Warrick kind of stat. But I don't know. I would expect to see Roger Mason be in the 16-minute range, and Brian Roberts in the 6-minute range, Austin Rivers to be in the 20-minute range.
So do you think then, I mean, obviously, when Gordon gets back in the starting lineup, do you think that means that we'll see Austin Rivers come in for stretches and be pretty much the guy that starts the offense and has the ball in his hand at the beginning of possessions exclusively? Or do you think that Monty will leave either Gordon or Vasquez, one of them, in with him? Do you see Roberts being in there? And how do you think that plays out?
I would like to see Austin Rivers come in and be the lead guard, at least for some possessions game. I really fully expect, though, that Austin Rivers will come in and replace Grievous Vasquez sometimes, and Eric Gordon will become the point guard.
Okay. Yeah, see, that I wouldn't mind. What I can't take is if they take both guards out and then they go with the Roberts-Rivers backcourt, and Roberts dominates the ball. I just can't. I'm fully behind Brian Roberts. getting fresh cups of water and hot towels for the team. I really don't want to see him playing and dominating the ball anymore now that Gordon is back. I think all of those possessions where the few possessions a game that the ball isn't in Vasquez or Gordon's hands, I want those possessions to go to Rivers. I want one of those three guys being the lead guard every single play of the game, nobody else.
I don't disagree. I mean, absolutely. I think I don't want Roger Mason Jr. ever being lead guard. I want him to be purely a spot-up shooter who might have to slash if he's closed out on and he has no other option. That's the only time I ever want to see him even dribbling the ball. And Brian Roberts, he's 27 years old. He's Pargo at, you know, better than Pargo at best, a little bit better. There's not a whole lot. I mean, Pargo is a guy who's not even in the league right now.
Yeah, I mean, if he could come off of screens and shoot the jumper, or he could be a kickout option for Austin Rivers, but I don't want to see the Hornets' second unit coming out there and Rivers just walking around or standing in the corner while Roberts is dribbling the ball. That just does nothing for the Hornets, both in the present and the future. So that's... You know, and quite frankly, I did see that in the Bobcats game. Is, you know, Roberts got 6 minutes in that game. It wasn't much, but when he was out there, he was just pounding the ball, had it in his hands, you know, misses his one shot, has two turnovers in those 6 minutes. Some of them, I mean, both of them basically led to fast break points, which kind of keyed that Charlotte run in the second quarter that put him up by so much. And it's just, I'm completely done with that experience. He's our fifth guard, and a fifth guard, when your team is fully healthy, shouldn't be playing.
So I'm going to say something here and you're going to think I'm crazy. You know who I think the MVP of that game is for the Hornets?
Let me guess. Okay. If I was a crazy person, I would think it's, I don't know who you're going to say. I mean, I don't know who you're going to say. Go ahead.
Grievous Vasquez.
So MVP, meaning that if you took him away, that would give the Hornets the least chance of winning. So if you took anybody else away.
For one play and one play only, Grievous Vasquez becomes the MVP of that game.
Oh, yeah, because the whole game comes down to one play. Okay, I got to hear this.
When he planted his knee into Michael Kidd-Gilchrist's eyeball and shook him up for the rest of the game, that was the game changer.
See, I don't even know. Go back and watch. Go back and watch that. His knee hits Gilchrist in the left, in Gilchrist's left side of the face, and Gilchrist reaches and grabs the top right side of his head.
Yeah, and I think Vasquez did reach out and get him across the face, and he might have poked him in the eye. I don't know.
Yeah.
If Vasquez was the one who took Michael Kidd-Gilchrist out of the game, he's MVP, because Gilchrist was freaking killing us.
Yeah.
He was one-man fast break off of misses, off of blocks, off of made shots. He was down court as fast as he possibly could. He was facing up Anthony Davis and schooling the crap out of him. And Davis had him a couple times, but, you know, successfully stopping twice when he was torching you like the other four or five times.
And I'm sorry. I mean, when he hit that elbow jumper, like, to me, the Hornets' first half, a lot of it was them playing bad, but a lot of that second quarter for Charlotte was just one of those nights type. I mean, they don't hit that some of those shots in an open gym with nobody else on the court that they were hitting in that second quarter, and, you know, Gilchrist included. But, yeah, there was a couple times he drove on him, faced up, and made some nice shots, and he was just getting the crowd fired up in that game. But, yeah, in the second half, he only had 4 points and no rebounds.
Yeah, and, I mean, it was purely that transition game that was murdering us in that first half. I mean, and him and Kemba Walker, those guys were flying down the court, and you didn't see it so much in the second half after, you know, especially when Kidd-Gilchrist wasn't out there, clearly. But even when Kid Gilchrist came back, you could tell he didn't have the fire and energy he did when he went out. So I really think that even if he maintained that energy for another 4 or 5 minutes at some point, I don't know if the Hornets could have made back all the way and then won this game in the end.
All right, I could maybe give you that.
And I love Kid Gilchrist.
Another thing, I mean, again, talked about the Aaron Gray matchup last time. Robin Lopez starts off this game pretty well. Then Charlotte brings in Brendan Haywood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like Lopez can't do anything because the immortal Brendan Haywood is on the court.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is what I'm talking about of we got to start thinking in terms of what is Lopez going to look like in the playoffs. And we see back-to-back games where he, at best, played to draws with Brendan Haywood and Aaron Gray.
Right.
I don't know how you could walk away from that game not completely excited about Eric Gordon. Other shout-out I got to give is when asked earlier this season who he would take, Ryan Anderson or Bismack Biyombo, Joe Garrity. Our own Joe Garrity chose Bismack. So there you go, Joe. 0 for 4, 0 points in 26 minutes from Bismack. While Ryan Anderson drops a healthy 19-8 on the Bobcats.
Yeah, well, I will say this for Joe. He says that Bismack in a couple years will be better. Honestly, I don't see it. I mean, defensively, he's fine. He's strong for that small little frame. He doesn't look like physically imposing out there, but he's athletic and he's physically strong. But the man has, absolutely no touch around the basket. He has no idea how to make a shot when he's under any sort of pressure at all. And what does that become for you? I mean, what's the ceiling for that? A short Dikembe Mutombo?
Mm.
A short Theo Ratliff?
Yeah. I mean, maybe he could become Larry Sanders. But then one other thing, we had the return of Eric Gordon, but can't forget Jason Smith also came back this week. He had back-to-back offensive possessions in this game where he hit his mid-range jumper at 4 points in like the first 45 seconds, and then he got into foul trouble, never really did anything after that. But in the two games back, he played a total of 17 minutes, went 3 for 8 from the field. Just really doesn't look like the guy that we saw earlier in the season or last year. But I guess moving forward, I mean, do you think the injuries are still bothering him and he'll get back to there? Or what role do you think he has on a completely healthy Hornets team?
I think he absolutely is still bothered by his injury. I mean, every time you see him, he's got ice packs all over that shoulder. I think the Charlotte game, though, was purely just bad luck. I mean, every time he moved, someone blew a whistle at him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he did, and a couple of them were, you know, 50-50 calls. It just didn't go his way, and he had to sit down again. He doesn't get respect because, you know, he's Jason Smith. He doesn't even have a name that people will remember. So, I expect that he will come back and he'll play more than 6 or probably more than 12. I still think that Monty 100% will be playing Lopez more like 22, 23 minutes. And I think we'll still see the 14, 16-minute Jason Smith games.
And
I don't know if I agree with it. In certain matchups, I don't agree with it. But Lopez, here's my thing with Lopez. I kill him all the time, and rebounding, he's so bad. But if he's having one of those offensive games, you got to keep him in there.
Yeah. No, I completely agree, and I guess I'm just wondering, we've seen more of this, of Monty saying, look, my small forwards stink, let me go with the 3-guard lineup. Is there any chance that he says, my small forwards stink, let me go with the 3 bigs lineup more?
If that happens, if they start shifting Anderson or Anthony Davis to the small forward position, then we might see an uptick in Jason Smith's minutes, but I still I have a hard time believing we're going to see more than, you know, 20, 22 minutes of Jason Smith on the court in any game. Just, I think Monty just really loves the idea of him coming in for the last, you know, 4 minutes of the second and 4 minutes and the first 4 minutes of the, last 4 minutes of the first and first 4 minutes of the second, and then him going back to the bench and letting the starters take over again.
All right, so my last question coming out of this game, and I know it's not a high possibility, but I just wanted to get your thoughts. So the Hornets without Eric Gordon this season were, what was it, 6-23. So let's say they have 53 games with Eric Gordon. Is there any chance, what would their record have to be, and what would his numbers have to be for him to be an MVP consideration?
For Eric Gordon?
Yeah.
He'd have to be pushing 30 points a game.
And what about the Hornets? I mean, I'm thinking about this more from a record because, again, now the Hornets are 7-3. They're a 700 team with Eric Gordon, and they're about a 250-ish team. I know it's not the hugest sample size, but if this team is 6-23 without him, and then let's say there's something insane like, 37-16 with him. I mean, is it a possibility?
The only way I could see Eric Gordon be mentioned for MVP is he plays the rest of the games, the Hornets make the playoffs. They can't miss. There's no way they miss, and he becomes an MVP. So they have to make the playoffs, which means they probably have to go, 40-13 or something like that, which is crazy.
I think they could get in at, 37-16, I would say, is the minimum.
Okay, which is, that's an amazing pace. He'd have to be pushing for the lead scoring without any question. I mean, because just look at New York. New York has a great record right now. They've been playing really well. Carmelo Anthony is, I think, second in the league in scoring. And the only things you see is Carmelo Anthony's not the MVP. I mean, if he can't get real consideration for it, how hard is it going to be for Gordon to do that? You'd have to have that amazing story of he led a team that was 7-23
right
into the playoffs.
And that's what I'm saying is the Knicks won last year without Melo. They've won. I mean, J.R. Smith just hit a ridiculous shot at Phoenix in a game without Melo the other night where they won. Like other teams, the Bulls win at a 600 clip without Derrick Rose. I mean, what more? You know, what screams MVP more than, their winning percentage goes up 500 points when this guy is on the floor compared to when he's off? I mean, I know it's ridiculous. It's one game against the Bobcats, but we have seen 10 games now in the career of Eric Gordon where the Hornets at a 70% clip and they're just downright atrocious without him. It's just something that, you know, as crazy as it is, this is the time where you could still think crazy with relation to how the world, how the year's going to play out. So just something that popped in my mind that I wanted to get your idea.
All they have to do is go on a 16-game winning streak right now. Match the Clippers. And, we're right back at 500 ball.
And see that, I mean, just to go back and again, with the Vasquez thing, I don't want to harp on it too much, but with people pointing at numbers, in that 16-game winning streak, I see so many Clippers games where I look at the box score and Chris Paul had 8 points and 11 assists, and they're winning games by 20. Like, the things that Chris Paul doesn't show up on the stat sheet, just controlling the pace of the game, getting hockey assists, just all the different little things that he does doesn't show up. So, again, sometimes statistics don't tell the whole story. But anyway,
Advanced statistics do. He's got a PER of 26.
Exactly. Advanced statistics do, and Greivis Vázquez is, last time I checked, he's in the 30s amongst point guards in PER.
He's up to a 15.5.
No, I'm saying, where does he rank amongst?
Oh, yeah, right. No, I understand. I don't know. I'd have to take a look at more stats than that.
Oh,
but he's up to a 15.5, which is a lot higher than he had been. I mean, things like steals and turnovers and efficiency of your shots mean a lot.
Right.
So
all right, we're back to exciting basketball. I do want to curb some people's enthusiasm. I looked at the January schedule. Essentially, the Hornets have 16 games this month. 11 of them are against teams that are currently in the playoffs. And of the 5 non-playoff teams, we're talking about teams that are borderline, like Dallas, Philadelphia, the Lakers, and the Jazz. And then there is one cupcake team in Sacramento on there. But, the schedule, at least for this month, doesn't get any easier starting with this week.
Yeah, I mean, Atlanta's first up, and Atlanta's been playing very well without Joe Johnson. Not that shocking. And then we get Houston. When we get that, it's actually suddenly that game has a whole lot of flavor to it to me. I mean, is there anything more exciting than to see two exceptional shooting guards going head to head?
No, I mean especially those two guys who were obviously competing for the last spot on Team USA. Both have, you know, their strengths in the matchup together, and I think that's going to be fantastic. By the way, just quick update. Greivis Vázquez moved from 38 earlier this week in PER, so he is now 29th, just 0.02 ahead of another favorite, Darren Collison. So he is the 29th ranked point guard in PER.
Right.
Which is about where he belongs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with that. That's isn't what we've been saying all year long.
Yeah, but we're still not nice enough.
We're haters. We're haters.
We are haters. Put your blockers on. I'm going to take the first one. I want to talk about Atlanta a little bit because they're such an
interesting team no one talks about.
They are, and even Lou Williams came out today and said that, you know, even he and the team are surprised by how quickly they all kind of melded together, because there was a lot of new parts on this team, and even with the guys who were holdovers, they had to take on completely different roles with Joe Johnson leaving. I mean, Josh Smith took on a different role. Jeff Teague, I would say by far, has had to make the biggest adjustment in his game post Joe Johnson. Brought in Lou Williams and Kyle Korver to add outside shooting. Devin Harris is kind of a steadying presence, Deshaun Stevenson, because every team needs to have one nutcase. but you've got a lot of you know, different guys on this team. They're starting to get John Jenkins, their first round pick, some minutes, and he's a fantastic outside shooter. I mean, he was the best shooter in college basketball last year. I think, you know, it wasn't even close. He's starting to get some minutes for their team. So they have a lot of really interesting pieces. You talk to any Hawks fan and they'll say it's not even close that Al Horford is their best player miles away. But I think Josh Smith gets the most national recognition. But Al Horford is still just such a solid player for this team, a good to borderline great rebounder on the defensive glass, and he doesn't kill you. He doesn't turn the ball over much for a big man. He has, a nice assist rate for a big. He could do multiple things on both ends of the court. So it's a really just solid team all the way down the roster.
Yeah, I mean, Horford, 16-10. And, I mean, he only gets one block a game, but yeah, you watch his defense, and he's just he's quick-footed. He's a little undersized, but he's quick-footed, so he stays in front of his guy and just makes their life miserable, and then bangs in the paint. I mean, players like him are always so underrated because they don't do anything spectacular. I've thought of Al Horford as a player I would love to have on my team any minute of the day. The one who surprises me the most is Jeff Teague. I didn't expect much out of Jeff Teague. I really thought that he was not going to be a very good NBA player. I thought he was going to be kind of more of a Jared Bayless kind of guy, where he just kind of played a little out of control. He has settled down, and he plays a pretty efficient brand of basketball and doesn't play outside of what he is. He gets out and runs when there are transition opportunities, and otherwise he gets the ball to his forwards and lets them work. I mean, here's the most underrated thing about this entire team. Josh Smith, Al Horford, Lou Williams, and Jeff Teague, that's four of their top 6 minute guys, are all averaging more than 3 assists. And Devin Harris is averaging 2.5. Is he injured right now? I can't remember.
Devin Harris?
Yeah,
he's got he missed the Indiana game with a...
He's been in and out.
Yeah, quote-unquote sore left foot. I don't know. I mean, at least if you're an NBA player, I want the training staff to put something cool on the injury report. Don't put sprained pinky or sore left foot. Like, give me some kind of cool something. But anyway, yeah, he's out.
Right. So, I mean, just to put that... you look at the Hornets team, and there is one player with more than 3 assists per game. Revis Vasquez. I guess Eric Gordon now as well. But
7 a game, baby.
7 a game, but it's one game, so I'm not going to really count that yet. So just imagine the passing that has to be going on this team. These guys have to be looking for each other all the time for 3 separate players besides the point guard to average 3 a game. It just makes – you can just picture right there how much better this offense must be if you're sharing the ball. Everybody's sharing the ball that much.
Yeah.
Even Kyle Korver, who is known as just a relentless gunner, is averaging 1.6 a game.
Yeah. Oh, that's – he might win the crown. yeah, I mean, they're a team that has dramatically – I mean, this was a team that just with Marvin Williams and – you know, with Joe Johnson having a less than stellar year last year, they were just a horrible team from behind the arc. And all of a sudden, with just a couple of moves, they've completely changed all of that to now they're a team that, you know, hits about 9 threes a game. It's a big part of their offense. And then on defense, it's the same old story. And it's going to be really interesting coming off this game in which Gordon got to the line at will. But again, this is a team that is not exceptional in their defense. I mean, as far as the percentage they give up, their defensive rebounding rate, all of it right in the middle of the pack, but they turn you over and they also do not foul you. I mean, this opponents have attempted, I mean, they've given up the least number of free throws in the entire NBA. You know, opponents have only attempted 515 free throws all year against them, which is, you know, the lowest amount in the league. They don't foul you. They turn you over. And I think if there's a game that I think is 100% necessary to get the best out of Eric Gordon, it's this one, because it would be very hard for Vasquez to run a successful offense against this team.
All right. I mean, even if he manages to get past Jeff Teague or Lou Williams, who are both pretty quick-handed, I mean, you get to Al Horford or Josh Smith, those guys are reaching in and poking stuff away all the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it'll be an interesting game. My prediction, though, is I don't think the Hornets are going to pull this out. I think that having Eric Gordon back makes a huge difference, but they're still working him in. They're still figuring out what they're doing. I fully expect the Hawks to roll in and pull this one out and win by 9.
Yeah, not me. I got the Hornets in this one. Hornets by 5.
Really?
I do. I think...
Think they're going to take us lightly?
No, I really think that if Gordon... I mean, I guess a big part of this would be if I could talk to Monty and see if he'll up his minutes. If Gordon gets 30 in this game, I think, you know, he could be exactly the elixir that we need to beat a team like this, both with their outside shooting and, you know, the fact that they just don't foul and they turn you over. I think if Gordon gets the ball in his hands on more possessions than Vasquez, I definitely think this is a winnable game.
Okay. So we're going to roll on to the Wednesday night game, which is the Houston Rockets. And they're led by their super shooting guard, James Harden, who is been, you know, they're 16-14. They're right there on the edge of the playoffs, and sometimes slipping in, sometimes slipping out. This team is just, it is a fascinating team to watch because other than James Harden, they've just managed to put together a bunch of pieces that seem to be working pretty well together. I mean, Jeremy Lin is playing pretty much average ball, Patterson average ball, Parsons average ball, Asik average ball. So if you just get a bunch of average performers, throw in a couple exceptional ones like James Harden and Greg Smith, who no one's ever heard of, has played very well in his limited stints, you got a pretty solid team here. And this team isn't even playing some of its people. Like Donatas Montajunas isn't playing. I mean, there are players on the squad that you kind of like, wait, what happened? Terrence Jones, 11 games this season.
Yeah.
The immortal Cole Aldrich only played 16 games. How are they winning without Cole Aldrich?
Yeah, or Scott Machado, who everybody wanted the Hornets to
right.
pick up. Yeah, they're a regular season team, and it's kind of gimmicky. It's kind of fluky. They get rebounds, and they just push in transition. They make no bones about it. They're just out to outscore you. They're not playing a game of chess. They're just flying up and down the court, trying to score more points than you. And on nights when they're hitting, like that Christmas Day game where they just absolutely blew Chicago out, you know, this is a team that when their offense is on could beat anybody in the NBA, probably outside of OKC, who just seems to get up for the games where they play Harden and just absolutely demolish Houston every time. But yeah, they just get out and run, number one pace in the NBA. They don't foul you at all. They basically let you have your shots. If you hit them, that's fine. They'll go down and try to outscore you on the other end, but they just play at a crazy hectic pace, which actually leads to quite a few turnovers, but it leads to a lot of easy opportunities and a lot of free throw attempts for this team. I mean, this is a team who, even though they only have one star, you know, and it's a guy who's a newfound star in James Harden, they get to the line, you know, almost as much as anybody. They're fourth in the league in attempts, in free throw attempts. So they play a kind of gimmicky scheme, but that, I mean, this is a game where if they're on, the Hornets and almost any team in the league could lose to this team by 30, 40 points.
And that's actually, I mean, that is why I actually think the Hornets are going to lose to them. Because I have yet to see a game where I've thought that the Hornets played good transition defense. And this team, I mean, Jeremy Lin, James Harden, and Chandler Parsons runs, Patrick Patterson runs, Omer Asik, their center, runs. This team is going to run the ball down the Hornets' throat. And, I mean, even if you add Eric Gordon to the mix, you got to have a good, solid transition defense to slow a team that runs it relentlessly. I don't see the Hornets being able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only counter would be as if the Hornets' offense was playing so well that it limited Houston's opportunities. If Eric Gordon was getting to the line, which obviously would put Houston in the half court. I mean, it's really one of those games. I know a lot of the times, you know, people will say turn defense into offense, but it's almost the opposite for this game. It's the Hornets' defense is only going to be as good as their offense allows them to be. If the Hornets are playing, you know, well enough offensively to keep Houston in a half-court game, it's winnable. But if their offense is off, this could just be a game that, you know, is a blowout pretty quickly.
Yeah. So what are you predicting for it?
I guess I'm gonna go Houston by 12.
Yeah, I'm going Houston by 3.
Oh, okay, so closer.
Yeah, I really think that while I think we're gonna be destroyed in transition, I just have a feeling that our 3-point they don't defend the 3-point line particularly well, and their Hornets. I mean, other than Eric Gordon now, and I mean their primary offensive prowess has been the 3-point shot. So I expect that, you know, they'll be able to take advantage of that and get a little hot and keep it close, and then just not quite be able to finish it off.
Yeah, see, where I'm really afraid is on the glass. I mean, you mentioned Greg Smith a little bit. For people who aren't watching, I mean, this is a guy who's like their eighth and ninth man, but somebody that they really developed through the D League, which, gosh, I'm wishing more and more as I see teams doing this, the Hornets could just get a D League team for a guy like a Darius Miller, because Houston did this with Greg Smith, and now he's playing fantastic in limited minutes. And, you know, both he and Ashiq have an offensive rebound percentage of about 12, which is very good. I could just see, you know, for at least stretches of this game, those guys dominating the offensive glass and getting Houston extra opportunities. When you combine that, you know, with the Hornets' tendency to turn it over sometimes, I think this could be a dangerous game again, unless the Hornets are just hitting at some of those clips that we've seen. I mean, we've seen even games this week where they've shot 70% in a quarter. You know, so it's really going to be all on the Hornets offense in this game. I think with it being on the road, eventually the Hornets wear out and Houston goes on a big run at some point in this game.
And the guy who will, of course, trigger that run will be the immortal Marcus Morris. It's a Morris warning game. Whenever the Hornets play a Morris twin, those guys are going to light us up.
And I'm telling you, it's Tony Douglas, too, the best player I've ever seen on NBA 2K13. Just cannot stop him no matter what I do.
Yes, I'm sure it's him and not you.
Come on, Mike. My stick skills are off the chart.
Right.
So, okay. I mean, I guess I would take a one-on-one week. You're predicting 0-2, but at least it'll be more fun basketball to watch regardless of what happens.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I hope when we do this podcast midweek that I come back and I'm able to see even more progress, and we can call it a 2-0 win week, and we see these Hornets developing and figuring things out. That would be... I would love it, but I don't think... I mean, it's really hard to work guys back in. I think it's going to take a few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, my expectations are even lower. If we come back to this podcast and Eric Gordon has played 3 complete games without a setback, injured again, Monty limiting his minutes because, you know, knee acting up something, that's my expectations. If we come back on this podcast and don't have to talk about anything physically or injuries or whatever, and could just discuss the games without any of those concerns, that would make me a happy Hornets fan.
Yeah, me too. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening to In the Know. We're going to have some guests coming up for you in the next couple shows, so stay tuned, and thanks for listening. In the party town, ain't nothing but a party.